Okay. You ready, Susan? Okay. We're going to just, we've got our microphone person here. We're going to just go around and group by group and collect here a couple things that you came up with. So, Tali, I think you're the only, yeah.
Well, we actually, Okay, we actually discussed this in relationship to the work that we actually do ourselves.
Uh-huh.
So we talked a lot about how multitasking has just loaded more and more and more onto our jobs. As other tasks are eliminated in other offices, they say, oh, well, you can do it, you know, add on. And also, I was saying that increasingly we're doing organizing and meetings as conference calls, as webinars,
mm-hmm.
and so frequently sometimes I'm on two or three of these a day, maybe a couple times a week, maybe more, and inevitably I start looking at my email. Yesterday I was writing up minutes from a meeting while I was trying to listen to a webinar with my ear like this, waiting for the, I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think that it changes the relationships we have with the people that we're organizing.
Okay.
So.
I think they just appointed you, Terry.
Okay, then I'm going to talk about what I said.
There you go.
I was talking about much of what had been happening over the last 5 years in terms of isolation of faculty, both from each other and from students. And it covered things like online learning, which I thought, Charlie, played right into the kind of interpersonal communication loss that you were talking about. But it also covered the way we used to relate to each other as faculty in meetings, and especially informally. Tess and I were both saying that the area that we work in is just so empty at certain times during the day or during the week that you don't have those other kinds of communications that used to go on outside of meetings.
Okay.
Let me just add that we think that the history of CPCS is a case study right in and of itself of a place where there was strong social networking, and it got busted.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, who knows what, I don't want to get into what the reasoning might have been. Maybe it wasn't in order to bust up social networks, or maybe it was, but by centralizing a lot of services, by getting rid of a lot of our staff, centralizing services to the university, that busted up the social networkings that existed, say, with student services and stuff, and it didn't replace it with other social networks with the university advising. It just got rid of those social networks.
Right. Yeah, and I would point out that a lot of these things, if you asked management and they were being honest about why they implement them, they're not actually implementing them to bust up social networking, but that's one of the outcomes.
And just from my my own experience in my work environment, people who I previously had communicated with, I'm being disconnected from and expected to take on the tasks myself, so that it's the communication, the physical communication of going to those people no longer exists.
No longer exists, okay.
Or it's discouraged.
Great. Next group.
Well, we had a really interesting discussion that kind of went on a continuum. On one end, in my workplace, I find that instead of getting phone calls, I get emails. People are really busy. They work through lunch, don't take breaks. They're isolated in their own office. Kim does online teaching. She lives in Massachusetts and teaches for University of Illinois. She never meets her students. She has no idea who they are. And then Donna brought up we talked a lot about younger people in their teens and 20s and how they don't even take phone calls. They text everything. And they've become very defensive and oversensitive when they have human contact. They don't understand tone of voice. They react because they're not used to that. And how it's going to affect interpersonal relationships or any attempts in the workplace to have a personal contact with younger people. They may become extremely suspicious and defensive because they are used to a more isolated world where everything is technology and they're by themselves.
It was interesting that, you know, the Chilean miners, they refused to send, there were two things that they refused to send down to them. One was personal listeners. They could have music, but not personal listeners. And the other was video games that you play by yourself. Because the psychologists who were overseeing the rescue operation said, you know, the thing that's going to get them to survive through all of this is social formation. And we're not going to give them anything that breaks that social formation down.
Christine from UMass Boston. We were discussing downsizing departments. Like, we had a copy center where you can go in there and buy things that you needed for supplies, like pencils. They took the whole department, completely gone. So now you have to order from W.B. Mason. Not only that, when you call, like, the admissions office or financial aid or whatever, you're getting a voicemail, and people's not getting their call, you know, return calls. I mean, I work in customer service, and I've gotten calls where people are like, oh, I called the registrar's office 2 weeks ago, no one's called me back,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then when you give them, you dial the number, again, they're going directly straight to voicemail. So that cuts down the lack of communication with people calling from either outside or even within the campus.
Okay.
Yeah, so my experience is working with security officers in Boston, and there's a lot that blocks Solidarity Building. You're on camera all the time. You're constantly monitored. So the use of technology in that way, breaks are always scattered because you can't have too many people off post at the same time. And then just the mentality of management that you're in security, I feel like you're almost to be seen and not heard. You're like the face at the door. And if people are caught talking too much, they'll be told not to. They're encouraged to, you know, not speak. And then in some cases, people are actually, there's a lot of competition and they're encouraged to snitch on each other. So.
Yeah, which will create divisions, yeah.
Yeah, in the printing industry, two of the specific things that we've seen are a move towards staggered lunches where there's mm-hmm. really no need for them. We have a press room across the street here that has four presses and one large room, and there's no reason for a production schedule to have staggered lunches, but yet they want to do that primarily to cut down on time because people talk to each other. And we've seen the same things within the edition, the printing of the paper. So at night you might have three or four editions, so traditionally they'd run the first edition, they'd shut down, and they wait for the second edition, or they'd put the second edition on and start up. But they don't do that anymore. What they do is they shut down one press at a time and start to plate the second edition on that press. And then by the time they have it timed so that only one press is down at one time. And it has nothing to do with time. It has because people spend too much time talking together. The minute the press shuts down, people wander over, they talk to the other guy, they talk to the other guy. And, you know, what should be a 10-minute plate up turns into 20, 30 minutes. So that's one of the things that they really started to impress upon is the staggered lunches and changing the work system within the press room.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
Bill Coy with the electrical workers. What everyone else has been saying, you know, we in the electrical industry have seen it also, maintenance workers being monitored, getting their jobs off of handheld devices, their work getting audited through those handheld devices, their stock, and there's no real need for them to go to the warehouse and pick up their stock for the day, which, you know, it individualizes all the workers. And I know it's very it's productive for the companies to do this, but I think it's also they had a benefit that they probably never really realized, and that's the divided workforce, that mm-hmm. it's very hard to organize these workers. One group I have in mind is ADT. When I organized those workers, I was awful surprised. There was 80 workers, and hardly any of them knew each other right. As I was having meetings. And as they came to meetings down at our union hall, you know, they you know, it turned into a grievance session, you know, all the things that have gone bad. And I let that happen because it just, you know, made them more angry, and you know, they, you know, at the end I'd say, well, this is why you need a union. And it was very, it was helpful in that respect, but I see a very negative impact for workers, especially young people. We talked a lot about the young people texting and not even using the phones anymore. And I think on a social level, that's going to be very difficult to overcome unless we tap into that technology and take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. I won't let the church off the hook either. So many of these things are going on. I come from the church thing itself and then the university setting and so forth, where the decision lines have been broadened so that if I want something done in my office and I have a nice relationship with the janitorial staff, that person can't make the decision until two or three people up the line clear it. The other thing I want to mention that some of you may be aware of is the spread of groups such as Sodexo. This is becoming more and more common in institutional settings, universities and so forth and so on. And they're into this stuff up to their eyeballs.
Mm-hmm. Well, at UMass Dartmouth, we're doing more and more stuff ourselves that used to be done by accounts payable, by the conference people. I mean, we have to do everything online, basically. And they're pushing hard, like what the University of Illinois is doing with more and more online courses. So you're losing that kind of thing. You still have some contact, but it's disappearing more and more. And you wonder, what's going to happen to those jobs that are all union jobs on our campus, or the people who are doing accounts payable, who are doing accounts receivable, and who are doing the conference room stuff when everything is being done online? You know, what's going to happen with that?
Right. I had actually a couple of examples, one from involving the people that we represent. I'm Ed Collins, IBEW, and most of my work is with the electric and gas utilities, some with radio and TV broadcasting. But in the utility industry, the tendency for more and more home garaging is really big. It's not at the level of the big distribution crews with the line trucks because it's just not appropriate to take them home. But anyone who can work out of a smaller vehicle, a pickup truck or a van, pretty much nowadays are home garaging, so they never come to that central location, or rarely come to the central location. They get their work by computer, or they get their work by cell phone, leave from their house, return to their house. So, and at the same time, with all the electronic stuff that is being used to deliver their work to them, that's also has the other aspect to it, which they know where you are every minute, how fast you're driving, if you're moving, if you're stopped, if the bucket truck is in the air or cradled. And so there's a lot more control by the company and less social interaction among the labor force. The other one is from my own work, and that is that, you know, a lot of those electronic advances that people have already talked about, I mean, it's kind of the way we're working now. We never see each other, rarely see each other as a staff, because we get all our work over the laptop. We get daily updates on our BlackBerry, all the stuff that used to go on at a staff meeting. We get on a day-to-day basis. There's almost no reason to ever come together as a district staff any longer, and it rarely happens anymore. So it affects us as well. And even in our new building in Washington, it's not brand new anymore, but the way they have that set up, the electronic pass that the people who work in the building have, basically, depending on what your job is, you only have access to certain areas of our office. I mean, certain floors that, you know, if you want to go up there, you have to call somebody and say,
because your key card doesn't work.
The key card won't work. And, you know, that's the way our national headquarters is actually arranged. And there's also not a cafeteria in there. There used to be in the old building, and I don't know this to be a fact, but rumor has it that a major reason for deciding not to do that was that they were tired of the palace intrigue about who's eating lunch with who today. Uh-huh. So everybody goes out to lunch. And so, you know, even in the union, I think the trend is towards far less, you know, cohesion and social interaction among the staff.
Yeah.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Which I didn't bring up.
Okay, you can add it.
But listen to everybody. My name is Patricia Armstrong. I'm with the Boston Teachers Union. And the last school that I worked in, the principal didn't like using the intercom system. And so we had two lunch periods, and he would come down at each lunch period if he had an announcement to make and just tell us what he wanted us to know. And I worked in the school for 4 years, and by the time I left that school, lunchtime, nobody sat in the teacher's room. There was no social interaction. Teachers were either doing things with their students, and the only time they got together was when they lined up at the microwave to heat up their lunches. And so even in the schools, there is, and this was, I've been working for the union full time for 10 years. So this was 14 years ago, everybody was together. And I don't know whether it was because of the change of leadership or not, but because we did have three principals in a 4 year period, but there was a major change in. It was a healthier environment when you could get together and gripe or talk about the good things, and that doesn't seem to happen anymore in the schools. Thank you.
I was just thinking about direct deposit, because I was a school bus driver at four or five different outfits. And, you know, you're off in your bus and with the kids, but paychecks were given out on Fridays at 10 o'clock. And you'd stand in line and you'd talk to people, and that'd be the time you'd look at the union bulletin board or if there was something, you know, about an upcoming meeting. And then, you know, direct deposit. You don't see anybody even when you're getting your check.
Yeah, I think, you know, the more you think about this, you'll go back and you'll say, oh, my God, I didn't even think of this. You'll see more and more ways that these divisions are being created, or not even divisions, just disconnections. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Consuelo, and while she was talking about the online courses, I was thinking that many more students are taking those courses, and I'm thinking about the doctors and nurses that are doing that. Made me think about and wonder, I'm getting old. How are they going to take care of me if those courses have been taken online? And before, in the old times, used to be taken in person and practicing. What kind of students, what kind of doctors are they going to become in the future?
If they're not keeping up, yeah. Okay. So, anyways, you see a lot of changes. Just a couple I wanted to comment on. This thing of breaks, I think, is huge. And more what we're seeing is people doing jobs where there's no set breaks. And it's, if you get a chance to have lunch, you get it, you grab it when there's a little bit of slow time, and you may still have lunch, but you're not having lunch with other people. I hear this a lot from nurses in particular, and healthcare workers, where there's just no longer any communal space. And in fact, they talk about the architecture in hospitals where the nurse's station has been eliminated. They've redesigned the nurse, the floors in a way that eliminates the nurse station, because now you have the computers on wheels, cows they call them, the computers on wheels that nurses can use, these movable workstations, so there's no central location where people gather and make those connections. I was doing a training once, and I was talking about home garaging and this whole aspect and how it affected people, and it was interesting because there was somebody in the room who was clearly getting very upset the more I talked about this. And I finally had to ask him. I said, what's the problem? He said, Charlie, right before I came to this training, management came to us and offered a proposal to split up the dining, split up the lunch periods. And he said, I thought about it from the perspective that our lunchroom is crowded, people have to stand in line to get their lunches or stand in line for the microwave or whatever, and I thought this is an advantage. So they were going to split up their three machine shops, and each machine shop would go at a different time. And he said, it's only in listening to this story of home garaging that I'm figuring out what, he said, these bastards were actually doing, is that they were, dividing the three machine shops from each other, eliminating that cross-fertilization and that creation of connections and creating a space where I would argue, if one of the machine shops has a problem and wants to take some action, it's going to be a lot harder to get the other two machine shops to go along because those personal connections that are key aren't there. I was just reading an article in The New Yorker about discussing the question of Facebook and Twitter and, you know, organizing online and what that means. And one of the interesting points that I took about out from it was they talked about Freedom Summer. And they talked about people going down and taking action in very dangerous situations, obviously.
I should say where and when Freedom Summer was.
I'm sorry, in Mississippi in...
1964.
Was it 64?
64.
Okay.
But then he was also talking about the Greensboro sit-in.
The sit-ins as well. And the fact that first the sit-ins happened from a group of people that used to hang out together, sneak beers into the dormitories together, you know, had those personal connections that they then decided as a group that they were going to take some action. It wasn't individuals. And they supported each other. But they also said that a study was done of the Freedom Summer participants. And what they found was that you were immensely more likely not to make it through the summer, to leave because of the fear, because of the danger, if you went there individually, if you went there with other people, if friends of yours were also signed up, you even if you weren't working with them, you were much more likely to stick it out and to stay through the summer. And it's that personal connection. And in fact, that ability, you know, if we have a connection for you not only to move me, but also to keep me moving, because I don't want to disappoint you, because I don't want to, you know, deal with the consequences. The peer pressure that we all understand is really part of building a movement. You can't have peer pressure if you don't have peer interaction. A friend of mine says it, you can't have collective action without a collective story. And the collective story of our experience in the workplace is being broken down by all these changes that I've talked about, and you've added a bunch. So one of the problems here is if we challenge management's plan, if we challenge what they're doing here, they come back with this management rights clause and say, we get to, you know, do whatever we want. In my other trainings that I do, I focus on what I call continuous bargaining, the idea that we actually do have to negotiate over all these changes, that if they're eliminating breaks or multi-skilling us or monitoring us, or we should be actually demanding bargaining and sitting down and bargaining with management and bargaining with an eye, in part, towards the impacts that these changes are going to have on social interaction, because I would certainly argue that social interaction and social connection is a core to unionism. Without it, it's very difficult. Very difficult. You're trying to organize people based on belief. Do you believe in the union? Versus organizing people based on human connections. And the human connections are the powerful connections. They're the connections that have been created in the past for us by the industrial structure, the structure of industries, and the connections that are now being taken away from us. So this is just a cartoon. Management is lighting their arrows. Can they do that? You know, it's just to try and express the feeling that management is getting away with a lot of changes that are having huge impacts, not only on our work today, but our ability to organize and represent going into the future. And too often, we're sort of caught flat-footed just watching it happen and not figuring out how to insert a collective voice into the changes that are happening today. And through that, protecting the collective voice in the future. The other thing I wanted to say, and people have sort of referred to it, but social interaction is one of the key determinants of stress in the workplace. That when you talk about where does stress come from in the workplace, it comes from lack of control, it comes from increased demand, and it comes from shortage of social support. So our workplaces are getting more demanding, right? More controlled, and we're losing social support. That's a recipe for stress and stress-related illness. And we're seeing, you know, increased heart disease and other kinds of illnesses that are...
Charlie, What happened to the promise of capitalism?
Darn! Was that what I was supposed to talk about?
Charlie,
yeah.
I don't want to get ahead of you.
To me, the difficult part is not recognizing this stuff, and the difficult part is not even trying to figure out a mechanism to attack it legally through collective bargaining. To me, the difficult part is how do you build the consensus among rank and file to think that this is a fight that's worth their time and effort and doesn't take a very, very distant backseat to the more traditional economic issues, because that's where I've had problems. Mm-hmm. Not saying what's the problem and how do we attack it, but how do I get people to place a high value on addressing these matters?
Well, they'll give you, not this year, but ordinarily they'll give you 20 cents to forget it.
Yeah. Well, I would say a couple things about that. One is I think it's hard to mobilize people around the question of social connection, but all of these changes that I talked about that are having impacts on social connection are also having impacts on other things that workers do care about, pace of work, you know, the intensity of work, how much work they have to do. So it's having an impact on things that I think you can actually get people to care about. And the other thing is that this is not something that just happens at contract time when, you know, sort of all the issues are on the table, but it's something that happens on an ongoing basis. And so figuring out strategies, I mean, part of this, the problem is we bargain once every 3 years and management bargains every day, right? Once every 3 years, we sit down and write a contract, and we think that's sort of setting the table for the next period of time. But management, the day after the contract signed, is making the kinds of changes that I've been talking about and degrading both working conditions but also the social connections. And so there's a temporal disconnect between how we as unions approach this conversation and how management approaches the conversation. So really trying to figure out, I think, part of this is a larger strategy of changing how we look at this so that we're taking on these issues on an ongoing basis, not just at contract time. The other thing that I would say is that getting language in our contracts that really sets up a mechanism and gives us a place for this conversation should be a key goal, should be something we should be working on. I was talking to Rand before he left about the fact that we both worked for the Teamsters back in the day when Ron Kerry was president of the Teamsters, and we got language on technology, on technological change into the UPS contract. Problem is, it never got implemented because of the change in leadership in the Teamsters. So we were talking about, you know, how different things would have been if we could have continued the progress that we were making in bringing some of these issues onto the table. Yeah.
The other side of continuous bargaining is education, and that's most of the people in this room understand that educating your labor leaders and the people that are actually sitting down and negotiating contracts know exactly what they're doing, understand management side, but also understand the labor side very clearly. I think that's very, very important, and that's a bigger part of this mission in general is to educate the people that are actually sitting down in your bargaining committees and make sure that they know what they're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, part of my goal in writing this paper and in doing this presentation and doing the presentations on this that I do is I think that this is an issue that is not paid attention to. And I think the example that I gave of the guy with the three machine shops, it had never occurred to him that this was creating a problem for him. It had never occurred to him that the move that management was making was going to create a solidarity gap in his workplace. He was only thinking about sort of the logistical issues of having three lunches and negotiated or discussed with management around the logistical issues. The home garaging is another example. In most places where home garaging is happening in unionized workplaces, there are things negotiated into the contract about, well, what happens if the van gets stolen, or what happens if, you know, it gets hit while it's sitting outside my house. Things to protect the individual in the midst of this change, but very little thought, in my experience, has been given to protecting the collective. And so proposals like, okay, you can do home garaging, but once a month, everybody's going to come together for a union meeting on company-paid time. Now, I know we can all laugh at that and say, yeah, that's ridiculous. We're never going to get that. But I think we have to start thinking that way, acknowledging the problem, and starting to think about what are possible solutions. Because if we just let it wash over us, I think there's a real decline in what I would call sort of the core, the foundation of the labor movement is these social connections that people make it work. We see this declining, but we're not even acknowledging it and we're not doing anything about it.
We're too busy.
So what I would say is the fight back against working alone needs to take place every day in our workplaces as management introduces these new technologies and restructures work. We have to add that to the way we think about changes in the workplace. I mean, a lot of the work that I do is focused on getting unions to even acknowledge that these changes are taking place, that they're significant and they need to be bargained. But the working alone piece is an additional piece that I think has to be added to this matrix, saying how are these changes going to affect the interactions and how can we take them on? Not saying that technology shouldn't happen or can't happen, not saying that work can't be restructured, but saying that we have something very important in our workplaces and our work processes to protect, and that's the social interaction that our workforce gets out of these. So what do we do? I've got a 5-point plan. I had to count. First, we have to acknowledge the problem. I think that's a huge step. If we could even get there, that would, I think, be a big step in the right direction. Look at threats to solidarity in the work process and the work process changes. It's just got to be added to how we evaluate what's going on in our workplaces. Secondly, we have to evaluate all changes in technology, work organization, and policy with impact on social interaction and solidarity in mind. So first, acknowledge that there's a problem, but secondly, actually put in place mechanisms to start looking at all of these and say, when this came in, when these things came in, did we ask the question, what's this going to do to social interaction? What's it going to do to solidarity? Third, bargain over all changes in the work process. That's the bigger thing is that unfortunately right now we're in too many cases letting management make changes without bargaining over those changes, bargaining over working alone or any other aspects of the changes. They're just making it because of this management rights ideology that seems to be so overwhelming, at least in this country. Fourth, create union programs for building interaction and building solidarity. If they're taking it away from us at work, then I think that means we have to pay more attention to figuring out how to build it outside of work or around work. That the natural connections that used to be created by the workplace, if they're not being created in the workplace, in the work process, then we have to pay some attention to how to do this. And I think again, Rand was talking to me about organizing Comcast workers and how they're very isolated from each other, but the union drive has become, you know, about building social interaction and social networking. It's an acknowledgement of the problem, but also seeing the union as part of the solution. And finally, build what I call an ideological defense of community / solidarity against the attacks of individualism. Way of saying there's a larger problem in society. It's not just in the workplace. There's a larger problem, and people have referred to it around texting and things like that, that increasingly we are isolated from each other. The ideology of individualism, no, you don't want Social Security. You don't want a defined benefit pension plan. You want a 401k. You know, you want something that's your own, and that if you fail at something, it's because there's something wrong with you. The sort of real focus on individualism. This is the place where I can tell this horrific story, because Pat, I wanted to tell you this anyway, so I'll just. My daughter teaches at the Little Frederick School, and what they decided to do the other day in one of the academies is they decided it was a good idea to have the students wear their MCAS scores. to school.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even I've told this to dozens of people, and I still get grossed out when I say it, because it's just how somebody who has an education degree can think that this is a good idea. But that's what they're doing. Again, my point there is the individualization. You know, it's like we're not in this together trying to learn. We're now competing with each other and, in fact, wearing that competition on our shirts every day.
Is that what the purpose of it was for, to have the kids compete against one another?
Or humiliation?
Yeah, what's the purpose? It's, you know, I'm sure what they would say, it's to motivate the kids to do better. But, you know, anybody that knows anything about this knows that that's not what's going to happen. In fact, it's going to cause dropouts. It's going to, I mean, my daughter in particular teaches English language learners who are going to suffer even more from this.
But isn't that good for the school to have the dropouts drop out?
Yeah, because... Exactly. That may be part of the plan. Anyways, my point, I didn't want to get off on that, although I did want to say it, but my point is that we're seeing a lot of trends of individualization in society. The book Bowling Alone talks about how socialization is breaking down. You know, we used to sit on our stoops and talk to our neighbors. Now we sit inside and watch TV. That people are doing less and less in society socially, and that, frankly, opens the way for people like the Tea Party to go on these individualism rants about, you know, if you were good enough, you'd be successful kind of thing. So it's not just in the workplace this is happening, but the workplace is a focus where people haven't really been looking at what's going on in the workplace and how serious this is, again, how serious it is for questions of solidarity.
They don't even build houses with stoops anymore.
Yeah, right. They don't have stoops. Yeah, just like they've eliminated the break room in the hospital, they don't have stoops. So that's the core of my presentation. I think the question of that I guess we'd like to have some more conversation about is, one, what do you think of this? Does this make sense, and is it a problem? Have I scared you sufficiently? But secondly, and more importantly, ideas for what can be done about it. What can be done about it, ranging from what do we need to do in the workplace, but I also think the larger question of how do we stimulate a discussion of this in the labor movement. You know, we talk in the labor movement about union density and the decline in union density and how that's a disaster for the labor movement, which I think it is. I totally agree. But I actually believe that this is an even more serious decline in union connection, and it's like our foundation is rotting and we don't even know it. And at some point the house is going to fall down and we're going to wonder why. Well, we're not paying attention to what's going on at the foundation. So the question of what can we do about it specifically, but also what can we do about it to generate some conversation about this so that it's an issue that's on the table. Okay. You go ahead.
Hi. I'm Susan Winning. I am the remaining labor extension program person at UMass Lowell. And I don't have an answer. I actually was going to pose add to the problem, kind of put together sort of what you folks talked about in terms of young people. And, you know, young people very much being into technology and texting and the you know, the graying of most of us who are activists and how often in just about every union setting that I'm in or labor council setting that I'm in, people talking about we have to reach out to young people. We have to. And so I feel like it just sort of, this is an exacerbated problem where we need to reach young folks to understand that this is an issue when, in fact, people live by texting and Facebook and Twittering and all these things that I'm really glad I'm not going to be around in this work that much longer because I just can't deal with it. But I just think that that is an added issue. And if anyone has any answers to that one.
Yeah. Yes.